one of the most underrated psychology books of the last 20 years, and it might genuinely change how you think about your own mind. Welcome to Claude Talks. I'm Emma.
And I'm Ryan. Today we're doing a full deep dive on Jonathan Haidt's The Happiness Hypothesis, a book that pulls together ancient philosophical wisdom and modern psychology and asks a deceptively simple question: what actually makes human beings happy?
And the answer, spoiler alert, is not what most of us assume. I read this book last year and I kept stopping to underline things, or just putting it down and staring at the ceiling. Like, oh, that's what's been happening.
That's the best sign of a good book. And I think what makes Haidt different from a lot of self-help adjacent writing is that he's a serious research psychologist. He's not making things up. He's curating what actually holds up.
So let's start at the very beginning, because the central metaphor of the book sets up everything else. Haidt introduces what he calls the elephant and the rider. Your mind, he says, is like a small rider sitting on top of a very large elephant. The rider is your rational, conscious, deliberate self, the part of you that makes plans, sets goals, argues about politics, writes to-do lists. The elephant is everything else. Your intuitions, emotions, gut reactions, habits, automatic responses, the deep, powerful ancient systems that actually run most of your life.
And here's the twist. We assume the rider is in charge. We think of ourselves as rational beings who occasionally get swayed by emotion. But Haidt argues it's almost exactly backwards. The elephant is driving. The rider is mostly just narrating.
And coming up with convincing stories about why the elephant was right all along.
Which is uncomfortable to hear, honestly. But once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Chapter 1 is called The Divided Self, and Haidt lays out four ways the mind is split against itself. You've got mind versus body. We all know the feeling of your body wanting something your mind says is a bad idea. Left versus right brain. Old brain versus new brain. The ancient limbic structures that handle fear, reward, and survival, versus the prefrontal cortex that handles planning and self-control. And then controlled versus automatic processing, the slow, effortful thinking we're aware of, versus the fast, effortless cognition happening just below the surface.
And what Haidt shows is that the rider, the conscious, deliberate self, didn't evolve to control the elephant. It evolved to serve it. To help the elephant navigate the social world. To rationalize its choices, defend its reputation, tell its story to others.
The philosopher's term for this is confabulation. You think you're reasoning toward a conclusion, but you're actually reasoning backward from a conclusion you've already reached emotionally. The elephant decided. The rider explains.
Which has enormous implications. Because if that's true, then what does it mean to change your mind? That's chapter 2. And Haidt's answer is fascinating. There are really only three things that have been shown to reliably change the elephant: cognitive behavioral therapy, meditation, and medication.
CBT works by teaching you to catch your automatic negative thoughts, the ones the elephant fires off before the rider even wakes up, and challenge them. Is this thought actually true? What's the evidence? Over time, with enough practice, you literally rewire how the elephant responds.
Meditation does something similar but through a different mechanism. It trains attention. It creates a tiny gap between stimulus and response, that gap where the rider can actually do something before the elephant bolts.
And medication, Haidt uses Prozac as the example, works by directly altering the neurochemistry that drives the elephant's baseline mood. Which is kind of uncomfortable if you believe in the primacy of the rational self.
But here's the thing Haidt is very clear about: insight alone doesn't work. You can't just decide to be happy. You can't just understand why you're anxious and thereby stop being anxious. Knowing is not doing. The rider can't override the elephant just by knowing the elephant is there.
And that was such a relief to read, honestly. Because I think so many of us have been doing this thing where we analyze ourselves to death. I know exactly why I'm doing this unhealthy thing. I've traced it all back to childhood and I'm still doing it. That's the rider understanding the elephant perfectly and still not being able to move it.
What you can do is create conditions for the elephant to change. Environments, practices, relationships. You set up the world so the elephant naturally moves in a better direction. Which is a much more honest and practical way to think about change.
Okay, let's move to chapter 3, which is about reciprocity, and it's one of the most eye-opening chapters in the book for me. Haidt makes the case that reciprocity is the single most universal principle of human social life, across every culture ever studied. We return favors. We punish betrayals. We keep score even when we say we don't.
And it runs deep. There's research showing we have what's called a snake detector neural circuitry that flags cheaters and threats almost instantaneously before we're consciously aware of it. The social world activates the same fast, automatic systems as physical danger.
Which explains why being wronged feels so visceral. It's not just a rational assessment of unfairness, it's a threat response.
Haidt also talks about gossip here, and I love this reframing. We think of gossip as a vice. But it's actually a social technology, a way of enforcing norms and punishing bad behavior without any central authority. Gossip is how small-scale societies kept people honest.
And then there's the famous tit-for-tat strategy from game theory: cooperate first, then copy whatever the other person does. It's the most evolutionarily stable strategy in repeated interactions, which means it's probably baked into us. Be nice, but don't be a pushover.
And here's where it connects to the elephant: all of this social calculation, the threat detection, the reciprocity, the norm enforcement, is happening below consciousness. Your elephant is doing social algebra 20 times a second. The rider just gets the results.
Chapter 4 shifts to something maybe a little harder to sit with: the faults of others and our complete blindness to our own. Haidt introduces the concept of naive realism, the near-universal assumption that we see reality as it is, while people who disagree with us are biased, stupid, or misinformed.
It's not just that we think we're right. It's that we can't conceive of the possibility that we're seeing through a distorted lens, because the lens is invisible to us.
And this ties to the fundamental attribution error, one of the most replicated findings in social psychology. When other people do something bad, we attribute it to their character. She's selfish. He's lazy. But when we do something bad, we attribute it to circumstances. I was under a lot of stress. I didn't have enough information.
The elephant is constantly running a PR campaign on behalf of you. Haidt quotes this: the human mind is a story processor, not a logic processor. We are built to construct coherent narratives that make us the protagonist and everyone else the supporting cast.
And the mote and the beam, that biblical image, is Haidt's way of pointing out just how asymmetric this is. We're hypersensitive to tiny flaws in others. We're nearly blind to our own enormous ones. It's not hypocrisy exactly. It's how the elephant works.
But here's where it gets constructive. Once you understand this, you can start to apply it. When you find yourself in a conflict and you're absolutely certain the other person is wrong and you are right, that certainty itself should be a flag. Not because you're definitely wrong, but because the elephant is not a reliable narrator.
Now we get to the chapter one thing most people pick up the book for, chapter 5, the pursuit of happiness. And Haidt opens with what he calls the hedonic treadmill, the finding that we adapt to virtually everything, good and bad, and return to our baseline level of happiness.
Lottery winners. Paraplegics. Both groups, within about a year, have returned to roughly the same level of life satisfaction they reported before. The event that seems like it would change everything doesn't.
Which should be devastating news, but it's also liberating in a way, because it means the thing you're desperately chasing, the promotion, the house, the relationship, won't actually deliver the sustained happiness you expect.
Haidt goes through all the things people think will make them happy and examines whether the evidence supports it. Money? Up to a point, basic needs matter. Beyond around $75,000 a year, the correlation with happiness basically flatlines. Stuff? Same thing. Achievements? You feel the rush, then you adapt.
And here's the really counterintuitive one: getting what you want. We think if we could just get what we want, we'd be happy. But we're famously bad at predicting how we'll feel in the future. What psychologists call effective forecasting. We overestimate how good the good things will feel and overestimate how bad the bad things will feel. Nothing is as extreme as it seems in advance.
So what does actually correlate with happiness? Haidt points to close relationships, meaningful work, Flow states, Csikszent Mihaly's idea of being fully absorbed in a challenging activity where your skills match the demands. Having a sense of control over your environment. And the progress principle, happiness comes not from achieving goals but from moving toward them.
That last one hit me. The journey, not the destination. Which sounds like a cliche. But when you understand it through the hedonic treadmill, it becomes structurally true. The destination is adaptation. The journey is engagement.
And about 50% of our baseline happiness is heritable. This is the set point research from Lukin's twin studies. Which means we can't completely escape our elephant's default mood. But it also means the other 50% is genuinely up for grabs.
Chapter 6 is about love, and Haidt starts with Bowlby's attachment theory. The idea that our earliest relationships with caregivers literally wire us for how we'll connect with people for the rest of our lives. Secure attachment, anxious ambivalent attachment, avoidant attachment. These patterns start in infancy and show up in our adult romantic relationships decades later.
Which is not an excuse, it's a map. You can change attachment patterns, but you have to do it the slow way, through new relationships and new experiences that gradually retrain the elephant.
And then Haidt makes this really clarifying distinction between passionate love and companionate love. Passionate love, the dizzy, obsessive, can't stop thinking about them early phase, is driven by novelty, uncertainty, and the neurochemistry of pursuit. It's not built to last. It's not supposed to last.
Dopamine loves uncertainty. Once the relationship is secure and predictable, the reward signal diminishes. That's not a failure, that's biology.
What can last is companionate love. Slower, quieter, built on trust and shared history, and the deep comfort of knowing someone truly knows you. And Haidt argues that this is actually richer and more sustaining than the passionate version, even though it doesn't feel as intense.
The love is blind finding is interesting here too. New couples systematically overestimate their partners. Which sounds delusional. But Haidt argues it serves a function. Commitment requires positive illusions. You need to believe this person is extraordinary to stay through the parts that are hard.
Chapter 7 is called The Uses of Adversity, and I want to tread carefully here because Haidt does too. The adversity hypothesis, the idea that people need challenge and setbacks to develop character, is backed by real evidence. Post-traumatic growth is a documented phenomenon. Many trauma survivors report that after going through something terrible, they emerged with new priorities, deeper relationships, a more vivid sense of what matters.
But, and this is crucial, that is not the same as saying trauma is good. Or that adversity always builds you up. Haidt is very clear, whether adversity produces growth depends enormously on two things. One, how severe it is, there is suffering that simply breaks people and doesn't build them. And two, whether they have adequate social support and time to process it.
Nietzsche's "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger" is partially true. But it glosses over the part where what doesn't kill you can still leave you quite damaged, and where many of the people it kills were perfectly fine before.
The practical insight is about conditions for growth. If you've been through something hard, the path forward isn't just time, it's connection and reflection. Support from people who care about you. Enough distance to find meaning in what happened. Not too fast, not too forced.
Chapter 8 brings in Aristotle, and I love that Haidt does this. He's constantly weaving ancient philosophy and modern science together, showing that the ancients got more right than we credit them for. Aristotle's concept of eudaimonia, usually translated as happiness, but better translated as flourishing, is not about feeling good. It's about living well, realizing your potential, expressing who you are through how you act.
Haidt distinguishes between hedonia, the pleasure and pain dimension, and eudaimonia, the flourishing dimension. Both matter. But eudaimonia is what gives life its sense of depth and meaning.
And he connects this to the research on character strengths, specifically the VIA framework, the values in action classification. The idea is that each person has a set of signature strengths, curiosity, kindness, creativity, leadership, whatever yours might be. And when you spend your days expressing those strengths, you feel engaged, energized, and like you're being your true self.
Csikszentmihalyi's flow research meets Aristotle's virtue ethics. And Haidt's synthesis is, virtue is not a rule you follow, it's a skill you develop. You practice it until it becomes habitual, until it feels natural, until your elephant moves toward virtue without the rider having to push.
Which is such a different frame than morality as willpower or compliance. It's morality as growth.
Chapter 9 goes somewhere a lot of psychology books avoid: religion, spirituality, the sacred. Haight isn't pushing any theology, he's asking a scientific question: why do humans universally have these experiences, and what do they tell us?
He talks about moral elevation. This specific emotion you feel when you witness something extraordinarily kind or generous. It's felt physically in the chest. It makes you want to be better. And he argues this is a distinct emotion, not just happiness or admiration.
And then awe, the emotion triggered by confronting something vast, something that doesn't fit your existing mental categories and requires you to update them. A mountain range. A piece of music. A scientific idea. Awe is disorienting and expansive at the same time.
And Haight uses the anthropologist Richard Schwetter's framework of three ethics to explain why secular and religious people so often talk past each other. The ethic of autonomy, based on harm and fairness, individual rights. The ethic of community, based on duty, hierarchy, loyalty. The ethic of divinity, based on purity, sanctity, the sacred.
Western secular liberals tend to use almost entirely the autonomy ethic. Religious and traditional cultures use all three. And when someone argues from the divinity ethic, this is sacred, it shouldn't be traded or contaminated, and the other person only recognizes the autonomy ethic, they literally cannot understand each other.
The elephant responds to the sacred. The rider argues about principles. And neither side can hear the other because they're speaking different moral languages.
So we come to the final chapter. Happiness comes from between. And this is Haight's full synthesis, and I think it's genuinely one of the clearest, most integrated conclusions I've read in any book about human well-being.
The setup is this: we have two intuitions about where happiness comes from. One, it comes from inside you. Get your mind right, cultivate the right attitudes, and you'll be happy wherever you are. Buddhism, Stoicism, a lot of therapeutic thinking, this is the within view. Two, it comes from outside you. Get the right things, the right circumstances, the right achievements, this is the consumer culture view. Get what you want and be happy.
Haight's argument is that both are wrong. Or rather, both are partially right. Happiness comes from between. Between you and other people. Between you and your work. Between you and something larger than yourself.
He gives the formula. H equals S plus C plus V. Happiness equals your set point, the heritable baseline, plus your conditions of life, your relationships, environment, whether your basic needs are met, plus your voluntary activities, how you spend your time, whether you're using your strengths, whether you're engaged in meaningful work.
And the profound thing is that this is exactly what the ancient philosophers concluded too. Confucius. Aristotle. The Stoics. The Buddha. They all arrived, through very different routes, at the same answer. It's about how you live in relation to others, not about internal states or external acquisitions.
The deepest meaning comes from three sources, Haight says. Loving and being loved, real deep attachment. Doing work that uses your signature strengths, the engagement and flow of using what you actually are. And being part of something larger than yourself. A cause, a community, a tradition. Something that puts your small life in a larger context.
And here's where the elephant and rider metaphor comes back one final time. Remember, the elephant is powerful, drives most behavior, doesn't respond to direct commands. The rider is conscious, verbal, can plan and reason. They've been at odds throughout the book.
But Haight ends with this beautiful image. When the rider and the elephant are aligned, when your conscious values and your deepest intuitions are pointing the same direction, when what you think you should do and what you actually want to do are the same, you experience something that feels almost effortless. Something that people across cultures and centuries have described as grace, or flow, or rightness.
And the conditions for that alignment are almost exactly the conditions for happiness. Loving relationships. Meaningful work. Connection to something larger. When those are present, the rider isn't fighting the elephant. They're moving together.
That's what I think makes this book so useful beyond the individual insights. It's not a list of tips. It's a framework for understanding why you are the way you are. and a set of genuine levers for changing the conditions that shape you.
Haight respects the reader's intelligence enough to say, you can't just decide to be happy. But you're not helpless either. You can train the elephant. Slowly, patiently, through the right practices and the right relationships. The ancient wisdom and the modern science agree on this. Which is about as strong an argument as you get.
If you haven't read The Happiness Hypothesis, this episode is your reason to. It's been out since 2006 and I think it's more relevant now than ever. In a world full of quick optimizations and life hacks and productivity systems, Haight is asking the deeper question, what does a good human life actually look like?
And the answer involves your elephant at least as much as your rider. Probably more.
That's it for today on Claude Talks. Thanks for spending this time with us. If this landed for you, share it with someone. That's its own little act of reciprocity.
Take care of your elephant. And your rider. See you next time.